I knew it was at least 35 below. And we found out later it was much colder. I come up over a knoll, and I'm coming down on what looks to be a pond. And on the other side of the pond, I see him flashing his light really rapidly. Just boop, 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 boop. And I assume, okay, there's some kind of danger. Moose in the trail, you know, more overflow. We've been dealing with that. No big deal. But I'm, you know, charging down this ridge really fast. So by the time I look from him and look down at my lead dogs are already swimming in open water, like completely swimming, like can't touch the bottom.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to this sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of this sport, in-depth interviews with a top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Hello guys, we are back with Jonathan Hayes talking about his expedition across Alaska this past January 2025, and we are talking about the first third of the expedition in terms of geography. For those that are sitting here listening to our podcast with their map, this is Nenana to about Galena. So that is from the road system to the Yukon. When you're talking about this, I've traveled this trail a few times, so I am very familiar with the landmarks. Jonathan, can you tell us a story about the send-off, that first third of the race?
Yeah, there are a few. So when, you know, if you're traveling that kind of terrain and visiting those kinds of villages, there are a few stories that really jump out. I will say that there was unprecedented conditions, and that's not me saying it. That's actually those were the words of Aaron Burmeister. The conditions are unprecedented. Alaskan distance races were being canceled all over the state because of these conditions, the massive amounts of snow and then extremely warm weather and then rain that turned it all into overflow on the rivers, which are usually the travel corridors. So there were a lot of, you know, armchair quarterbacks saying, you know, you can't do this, you shouldn't do this. I actually had a lot of natives in the communities. I've developed great friendships with them over the last year or so. I feel like I've got family all through there now. But they were saying, you know, Jonathan, we don't even travel between villages until about the second week of February. Like, just, you know, it's in general, the conditions are bad the last week of January, the first week of February. And then you add to that these unprecedented, you know, avalanches, you know, overflow, you know, all this stuff. A lot of people were saying, can't be done, shouldn't be done, shouldn't even be tried. And but thankfully, when we pulled into Nenana, Matt Krentz, who's a trapper in the area, and Aaron Burmeister, who's a 23, 24 time Iditarod finisher who lives in Nenana, he understood that, like, Jonathan's doing this. And so instead of telling him it can't be done, we need to help him find a way, you know, to get him underway. So I can't say thank you enough to that support that we got when we got to Nenana. They understood the mission, and the mission was this has to start January 27th. And the river was unnavigable because of the overflow. We ended up still having to travel some of it, though, and that is a horror story in itself. And the overland trail, had experienced a wildfire, and it was just 20 miles of, you know, the old game of pickup sticks, you know, so that trail was unnavigable. Thankfully we were able to piece together some, trapper line trails, that were really swampy and, really bad on the snow machines to get us within 7 miles on the Tanana River from the Telavana Roadhouse. and then make it up from there. So I want to say thank you to them. But it took us, I think, 3 or 4 hours to travel that 7 miles on the Yukon that night. On the Yukon, on the Tanana River that night. To get to Tullabana Roadhouse, they had to drop the freight trailers just, you know, to be able to make it. Remarkably, as you might expect, we spend a lot of the time with my 16 dogs just waiting for the snow machines to get out of the way so that we could go. And, you know, I was really proud of my dogs. I mean, once the snow machiners got out of the way, they would dive into whatever had the snow machiners trapped and, you know, pull themselves out on the other side. And that's the beauty. I'd never run consistently run a team of 16 dogs like this before, you know, on an ATV or something, but that's different. What I've seen with the beauty of having a long team is, you know, once your dogs start getting across whatever the obstacle is, all you've got to do is hold on and they're going to get you to the other side. Once you get that much power on the other side of the obstacle, they're going to, you know, you might be broken when you come out on the other side, but they're going to get you there. And already we started to, well, you know, I'll tell you this, the day before the expedition, Jamie and Jeff went out and, they sent me a message from the trail on our,
inReach.
Can't be done. Must find another route. And, because they had just gotten swamped so much. And I was like, man, this is plan C. You know, the overland route's closed. The river's closed. This is plan C. There is no other way. I mean, this has to work. And so what we decided to do is, it was still 35 degrees, but there was this massive temperature shift that was coming. And so what we decided to do is, you know, I'm just going to mush out of town about a dozen miles, and then we'll park for the day, pick up there the next day. And by then the temperatures will start dropping enough to where things will start firming up and we'll attempt that crossing, you know, over to Tullabana Roadhouse. The hosts at Tullabana Roadhouse, the only remaining roadhouse from the original Serum Run, they were really great to let us stay there, but they couldn't even make it out from town, you know, to host us. So we were on our own, really grateful for that. But what happened was we got there, wake up in the morning, and all I have for supplies for my dogs is what I had brought on my sled, because the snow machiners still had their trailers stuck miles back. And so I'm waiting for them to come back up, and then they decide, because the conditions are so bad, that they're going to shoot ahead without the trailers. They're going to leave the trailers at Tullabana Roadhouse. They're going to shoot ahead to Manly, turn around and come back and get them while I'm making my way to Manly. Long story short, I made my way to Manly and never saw them because they were cutting the trail that the Iditarod ended up using this year. They were cutting the trail with chainsaws and axes for 20 of the whatever it was. I can't remember right now, 50... 55 miles, whatever it is, from Tullabana Roadhouse to Manly. I told you I'd share a couple harrowing stories with you, and both of them fall in this third. So the first one was after they got back to Tullabana Roadhouse with the supplies and then took off, then I was starting to take off, and the snow was really deep. The only thing worse than an unbroken trail is a trail with, you know, 6 inches deep and, you know, shards of ice protruding up. And, you know, that's what we were dealing with. We underwent almost 100-degree temperature shift in the first 48 hours we were on the trail. It went from, you know, 40 above to, you know, we'll get to how cold it was when we get to Manly, but... So I'm mushing into the night because we got a really late start because the guys had to get the trailers, recover them and everything. And so they were way up ahead. How far ahead, I didn't know. The cameraman was playing leapfrog with me, where he would, you know, get somewhere picturesque, video me coming up, and then he'd take off again. So, you know, I'd see him like once an hour, once every 2 hours. And it was about midnight, and I knew it was at least 35 below. And we found out later it was much colder. I come up over a knoll, and I'm coming down on what looks to be a pond. And on the other side of the pond, I see him flashing his light really rapidly, just boop, 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 boop. And I assume, okay, there's some kind of danger, moose in the trail, you know, more overflow. We've been dealing with that. No big deal. But I'm, you know, charging down this ridge really fast. So by the time I look from him and look down at my lead dogs are already swimming in open water, like completely swimming, like can't touch the bottom. And, you know, I drop both of my snow hooks and slide, half run, slide, you know, down the ridge. And I'm hoping that they're going to self rescue before I get, you know, to the ice. And there's just no way. Every time they grab a hold of the ice, it breaks. And now my, you know, my point dogs are half in, half out. And so I flop down on my belly, low crawl out there. You know, I get on the edge of the ice and I'm reaching out and finally grab a hold of one of my leader's harnesses. And if you can imagine just the ergonomics of this don't work. If you're laying on your belly and trying to lift two 50-pound dogs into the air over your back, laying on your belly, that doesn't work. So as I was lifting them, I had to turn on my side. And when I did, all of that weight concentrated on that one spot just sent me right through the ice. And so now, and you know, I've been asked how deep the water was. I don't know. All I know is I couldn't touch the bottom. Like my feet were not touching the bottom. And then my lead dogs are using me, you know, as a ladder to climb out of the water. And this is the middle of the night. And I'm still, how far was I? I think we were still about an hour and a half to 2 hours from Manly. I've got all the facts written down, but it'll be in my book. But so I do what they taught me in the Marine Corps. I was actually in a cold weather infantry unit in the Marine Corps. And so I did lose my cool and got really scared later on in the expedition. But I was really surprised that I didn't in this moment. Like, I was not really at any point really concerned. You know, I just started doing this little, you know, paddle kick with my feet until my body came up level with the ice. And then I started scooting onto the ice while, you know, continuing to hold on to the leaders and pulled them out. And pulled them out, but I'm still on the wrong side of the pond or whatever it was. And so I'm looking for another spot to cross, and I see what I think might be better. Get halfway across, we plunge through again. And this time, my dogs were like, oh, look, a human bridge to get to the other side. And the team just starts climbing over me and pushing me down as they're going in. So I get out, and I hear a voice, like I'm untangling my dogs, and you know, I'm frantically moving, and something that I'd never seen before, like ice was crystallizing on my hand as fast as I could brush it off. Just the humidity coming up from my body was forming a sheet of ice on me. And so I'd wipe it off and work, and it'd freeze back up again and wipe the ice off and work. And then I heard a voice go, John, if you need me to do anything, just let me know. And I was like, I'd forgotten anyone else was there. And I look over and the cameraman's just filming the whole thing. So it's going to be in the documentary, right? So he's just like filming this whole thing. And he was, you know, going to start a fire, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, that'd be the best thing for me, but it's not going to be the best thing for my dogs. My dogs are drenched. And, you know, so I unhooked their tug so they could do what they would naturally do, roll around in the snow, let the snow absorb the moisture from, and then they'd get up and shake it off and they'd roll around in the snow again. And then they're grooming themselves. And I'm like, I got to get this team moving. Like, I got to get them moving, and we can't stop until, you know, we get there. So that's what we do. I'm a solid sheet of ice from head to toe by the time we pull into Manly. And we're at the Native Community Center, hosted us in Manly, which was a great honor. And Jamie and Jeff come out and they're like, man, we were just about to come out looking for you. And I realized at that moment that, you know, our supplies are still back in Televana Roadhouse. And so it was at this point that I had to make the first adjustment of the expedition and say, okay, we're sitting right here until we get back on track and our supplies are going ahead of us instead of coming up from behind us.
And that is actually a question coming up there. Jonathan, I don't want to interrupt your stories. Otherwise, we will have 10-hour episodes for sure. But before we jump into questions, obviously, overflow is a huge deal. In Alaska, it's probably one of the most deadly experiences in the backcountry. I've been there. I've done that. I don't know how many times. Same, similar stories to yours. But just sitting here thinking, that is truly your iron will moment. That is saving Gus in the movie situation. Unfortunately, in that point, if I recall, that was when Will's dad died in overflow, right?
Yeah.
So that was the lead up to the whole story. That was right. The hero's journey of that story. I got involved with Mushing because of that movie back in 1994.
Yeah.
I think you have a similar story. Is that right?
Yeah. My brother and I can actually, my new apprentice, he's a Lakota Sioux young man, Aspen Michaud. Part of his induction into Mushing was he had to sit down and have a pizza movie night with me and watch that movie. And he was like, what's wrong? And I said, what do you mean, what's wrong? He goes, you've stopped quoting every line. What's wrong?
Yeah, we watch that every year. I teach Mushing in college, and we have the same thing. Before we take them out on sleds, we watch a movie, Disney movie, of course, from 1994, and it's that movie in particular. And then we address that movie at the end of the course.
Yeah.
What did you learn, etc. Okay, let's jump into some of these questions. But before we do, for folks following along on the map, we are at Nenana, we're at Minto, we're at Tolovana.
Yeah, man, that story just brought us to Manly.
So you're at Manly, then we have Tanana, which is the confluence of the Tanana and the Yukon. Mm-hmm. The next several days, you are on the Yukon. Then we have Ruby, a very historic type community there on the Iditarod and the Serum Run. And then we have Galena, which is further up down the Yukon. Out of those communities that we listed, which is your favorite?
That's hard because I call Cynthia Erickson out of Tanana. I call her the Athabascan Queen of the Yukon. If you know her, then you're a shoo-in in the communities along the Yukon. And she was such a gracious host to us. And in Ruby, there's Nate Titus, who was grandson of the original musher who I had mush my team for a little while going out of town. So I really enjoyed. We almost stayed a day in Ruby to do more school presentations there. And again, as Providence would have it, I decided to push on because we had a big schedule at Galena. They have multiple schools there that wanted us to speak. So we ended up deciding to push on, and when we did, that's when I was about a couple hours out of town. And by this time, we had reached kind of a rhythm where the guys were staying behind, cleaning up, getting fueled up, and around 11 o'clock, they would leave the village and catch up to me about midday, and then they'd pass on ahead of me. So other than that midday pass, I was by myself all day. It was beautiful. But I got about 2 hours out and saw a figure on the Yukon, standing in the middle of the Yukon. And I was just in the middle of nowhere. And it was freaking the dogs out. Humans don't freak my dogs out, and animals don't. And so I was like, man, is this some kind of spirit? You know, like, what weirdness is going on here? And the reason why it freaked them out is because it was a half-frozen elderly native that was walking with a severe limp because his feet were frozen and his hands were frozen. Just the way he was moving freaked out the dogs. And the moment I pulled up to him, he just collapsed onto my sled. And So it was, I think it was providence that we were there when we were there. And, you know, again, you know, people are like, oh, you know, you rescued someone, you're a hero. And I'm like, anyone passing through there would have done exactly what I did. I gave him my coffee. I covered him in my extra anorak, put heat packs on him and called for help. I
mean, and was this
between Ruby and Galena?
Okay. So about a 35-ish miles.
Yeah.
So at some point he had to walk that distance.
So he had tried to self-rescue the day before. He was going to Galena to see his mother in a retirement home. His snow machine had gotten swamped by the overflow. And I have a picture of my dog team up on top of the snow with his snow machine, you know, buried in the overflow. But he had gotten stuck, had gotten completely soaked, and had spent the night wandering around on the Yukon. I found him a half mile from his snow machine. So all of that wandering all night long, he had gone about a half mile. Mm. And, yeah, had we not been there, you know, it would have been a sad end to that story.
Let's jump into some of these questions. We've already answered a few of them, in particular teamwork and how they play into the success. We talked about strategic decisions and making those quick decisions in terms of getting your gear down the trail instead of backtracking back. Let's jump in and talk about communication. We talked a little bit about InReach and tech and all of that you were using back and forth. But how important is communication among team members on an expedition like this?
We, sadly, we thought that InReach and these text messages were going to play a pivotal role in our communication. It was so cold. Oh, and I forgot to tell you this. It said minus 50 when we got to Manly. And Chief Raymond of the tribe there, he said, no. It's minus 50 here in town. He goes, it's usually 10 to 15 degrees colder down in the valley you just came through. So we were at least minus 50 and probably around minus 60. But it had gotten so cold that my InReach, the InReach carabiner that's mounted onto the back of it, just disintegrated. And my InReach is somewhere between Manly and Tanana. So I did, you know, more than 2/3 of the expedition without any community. I would see my team in the morning. We would have a meetup in the middle of the day where we'd, you know, snack and talk and make plans. And then usually, not always, but usually as I got about 2 miles from the next village, Jamie or Jeff would come out with a snow machine to guide me through the village and guide me through the town and make sure I didn't get wrapped up with any local dogs.
So following up with the communication, did you have all of this set ahead of time with all of the villages, all the places you were going to stay? Did you have that already set? And was it on some type of schedule like, hey, we're going to be here on Tuesday, we're going to be here on Thursday? Yeah. Or was it just sort of play by ear?
So every night I would update the people in the villages where we were at in my estimated time of arrival getting to them. And that was important because we did 6 presentations at 6 schools along the way and spoke at 3 churches. So, you know, keeping that communication going so that people could know when to expect us was critical. But we did that every night as kind of a wrap up. We used the new portable Starlink, the small mini. And that means that no matter where we were, once a day, and I told everyone, you know, we'd use it for an hour every evening so that we could communicate with family, do some social media updates and that kind of thing.
All right. What about adaptability? You found very quickly that Alaska is its own animal. That portion of the state is a bigger animal. How was that adaptability in this, you know, kind of changing on the fly?
Yeah, as you know, you can delegate responsibilities as a leader, but you can't you can delegate tasks, but you cannot delegate responsibility. As a leader, the buck stops with you. And so when we got to Manly, I was frustrated that for the second day on the expedition, I'm here and our supplies are back there. And while I've delegated tasks, the responsibility as the team leader rests on me. So I said, okay, we're going to reset. And from this day forward, you know, we do not move forward without our supplies because it's unfair to the dogs. It's unfair to the other teammates. And so that was a day off the trail, which was, ended up being really great. Local musters came to introduce themselves. I got to hang out with the chief of the tribe there and interviewed them and had some really great stories for the documentary.
We have a couple of dog questions coming up, but in terms of timeline, Jonathan, from the day you leave Nenana to the day that you get to Galena, how many days is that?
That's a good question. We took that day in Manly to readjust, to the conditions. And then we took a day, for interviews with descendants and stuff like that, I think, in Tanana. So travel days, it was only 5 days travel days. Because we went to Tullivanna Roadhouse, then we went to Manly, then we went to Tanana, then Bible camp, and the cabins, two of the cabins that were on your trip are both washed into the river now, and thankfully the elderly couple at Bible camp hosted us there, and they were both suffering from COVID at the time, but yeah, so we were about 5 or 6 days in at that point.
And in terms of miles, what is that, about 200-ish miles?
Yeah, we had we were averaging about 50 miles a day, but we had 3 days that were 60-plus miles in a row. From Tanana to Bible Camp was over 60. From Bible Camp to Ruby was over 60. And I think there's another one there somewhere, but a lot of back-to-back 65-mile days.
So you'd been on the trail about a week to this point on about a three-week journey, which we're going to talk a lot about coming up. So we don't go over in terms of extreme time. Here's some kind of quick rapid-fire questions in regard to the dogs. What makes the Sepala Siberian dog breed unique compared to other sled dog breeds?
So unlike the Alaskan Husky, which is a mixed racing breed. This is a true Arctic Spitz breed dog that has not been bred for racing. It has been bred for working and racing in extreme conditions. So it's somewhere on the spectrum between your show dog Malamute and Siberian Husky, your typical Spitz breed show dogs like a Malamute, Siberian Husky, that kind of thing, and the racing Alaskan Husky, which is a mixed breed dog. These dogs are a purebred breed, but a focus has been maintained by the breed club for performance. If a Sepala has been out of a working kennel for more than two generations, it is not qualified to be a Sepala.
Speaking of that, since many of our fans listening are not mushers, a lot of them know exactly what a Siberian is throughout, popular culture. A lot of them know, at least in the mushing world, they all know what an Alaskan Husky is. I mean, it could range from everything. I mean, it is your Heinz 57 of dogs. You said performance. What is the difference between, in your eyes, what is the difference between performance and racing?
Well, I think a lot of mushers have done what you and I did, and that is we adopted some couch potato Siberian Huskies and thought we were going to go win a race. And what we found out really quick is that the mainstream Siberian Husky is not what it was 100 years ago. You can do okay, but there's that drive to keep going past 10 or 15 miles. It's just not there. So I had a choice, and it's the choice that all mushers make when they start out with show dog Siberian Huskies and realize they're not going to cut it. The choice is you move toward racing Huskies, the Heinz 57, as you called it, the Alaskan Husky, or you double down. And I'm a very stubborn person. I'm a double down person. And so for me, I was like, is there a traditional Arctic Spitz breed dog, is there a purebred dog that is still performance function based? And, you know, that was, you know, 30 years ago. And that's when I came to the Cephalus Siberian Sled Dog. I didn't even know at the time that Maine, where I lived, you know, had this rich Cephalus Siberian heritage until after, you know, I found the breed.
That goes right into the next one in terms of preservation of the lineage of the breed. Correct me if I'm wrong, but is the Cephalus Siberian, I know this answer, but I think a lot of the listeners don't. Are they still registered as AKC Siberian Huskies?
Some are and some aren't. And this is, and the reason why I say that is, to clarify that, there is an unbroken line from Leonard Cephala to the Cephala Kennels today that have kept their Cephalas distinct from the mainstream and racing Siberian Husky breed pool. When they got into bottlenecks and needed to add some genetic depth, they still refused to reach into the mainstream Siberian Husky breed pool to keep their Cephala Siberians as distinct. That's from the founding of the kennel in 1927 here in Maine to the present day. But because they're Siberian Huskies, they are eligible for American Kennel Club registration. The question comes in, you had guys in the 70s and 80s like Jeffrey Bragg and Doug Willett, who are the stewards of the breed, who felt like it was to the breed's detriment to continue dual registering them. Because as long as you're calling your dog two different things, no one, and you know, as the breed president right now, I can tell you this is a problem we're still dealing with today. Because some are dual registering their dogs, people are not taking the Cephala seriously as a distinct breed. But when you look at what constitutes a breed and what has made breeds distinct throughout, you know, let's say the German wire hair pointer versus the German short haired pointer, you know, or, you know, the yellow lab versus, you know, the golden retriever, you know, and all of these things. Forget the Spaniels, you know, there's a gazillion of those and they're all very, very closely related to each other, but they're individual breeds because of historical reasons, because of, you know, certain breeding philosophies. And, because we have had a very distinct breeding philosophy with these dogs in place for 100 years and have kept them distinct from it, from the mainstream Siberian Husky world. Rightly, the Continental Kennel Club recognizes this as a distinct breed. There is some conversation as to whether we want to pursue American Kennel Club recognition. But recently, and it just proved what we already knew, recently genetic studies were done on Arctic Spitz breed dogs. And you have the Cephala Siberian Sled Dog was tested, racing Siberian Huskies, and the mainstream Siberian Husky population. And where the mainstream Siberian Husky population and racing Huskies overlap, you've got the Cephala on the far end of the spectrum overlapping with the racing Siberian Husky genetically, but not overlapping with the mainstream show Siberian Husky at all. So they are distinct, very distinct, and our goal is just to keep showcasing that distinction in the breed.
So I know both you and I are music guys. We've been in bands in our quote-unquote distinguished careers. I guess a good analogy to that, Jonathan, is a guitarist and a bassist who plays a bass guitar are not the same thing.
That's right. And as a bass player that doesn't play the guitar, I can tell you that that it's not the same thing. Like very good bass players can not play the guitar, and very good guitar players, they might know what notes to hit on a bass, but that doesn't make them a bass player.
There you go. All right, last question for this episode is also a dog question. How do you maintain the traditional skills and qualities of this breed during training, not necessarily on the expedition?
Mm-hmm. Working performance. We aren't especially as Alaskan Huskies and Eurohounds and all of that evolves, we can't be holding ourselves to this ever-evolving standard of winning performance against, you know, German short-haired pointers and these other ever-evolving breeds. But what we can do is hold ourselves to the historical standards and look at what these dogs were doing both in winter hardiness and in race times and performances 100 years ago. And that needs to be a minimum benchmark for us, you know, as we, you know, gauge the performance of our dogs. I'll be honest and say that unlike someone like Doug Willett in the 90s who ran Sepalus and had over 50 first place wins in mid-distance races against Alaskan Husky teams. Unlike him, I don't have the racing experience. And unlike Mitch Seavey, I talked to Mitch about this a lot. Mitch says, your dogs are going to be different than mine. They're going to run different than mine. Their pace is going to be different than mine. And I'll be honest and say that after, 30 years mushing, 25 years devoted specifically to this dog, because most of that's been spent recreationally, I think that there's probably more to this breed that I've not unlocked yet, that there's probably something that I'm missing because maybe I'm training them like you would an Alaskan Husky team at Mitch Seavey's kennel, or maybe I'm trying. And so, and an example of that was what I witnessed on the trail, their true winter hardiness, as opposed to my Alaskan Husky Iditarod friends who said, in this situation, I thought I was going to lose a dog. In this situation, I thought, this was really dangerous, and I thought it would be really rough for my dogs. When we got in the most extreme situations, my dogs were looking at me going, "You're the naked monkey from the tropics. We belong here. This is home. This is exciting. This is fun." And so there's a lot to unpack there, and I'm still working on it.
That's the true nature of dog mushing, is that ever evolving aspect of it. And I love that part. I mean, I love getting out there on the trail and spending time with the dogs, whether you're doing expeditions or just long training runs. I would take that any day of the week over a race, and I'm sure you would agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, guys, this is episode 2 of our continuing coverage with Jonathan Hayes, talking about his expedition across Alaska to pay homage to the 1925 Serum Run. Hopefully you will join us next time. We will see you then. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.